Good morning. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's coming up on 10 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Tuesday, November the 27th. We will talk this hour about Senator Joe McCarthy with a guest who says he was unfairly maligned by his critics. And while you may believe McCarthy created a bogus Red Scare, that McCarthy smeared countless innocent victims, that McCarthy was a demagogue, a bully, and a liar, our guest this hour says you're wrong, and that McCarthy was right, at least about the threat of communist infiltration of the U.S. government during that period. And while he was not flawless by any means, McCarthy was not the caveman in the sewer, as portrayed by editorial cartoonists at the time. Our guest says that Joe McCarthy has been unfairly blacklisted by history. And we will wonder if you agree with him or not, or want to argue with him. Your thoughts and questions about the life and legacy of Joe McCarthy, welcome this hour. 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Please include your first name and your community with your email. Our guest is M. Staten Evans. He's a contributing editor at Human Events. He served for many years as the director of the National Journalism Center. Mr. Evans has also been the editor of the Indianapolis News, a columnist for the Los Angeles Times Syndicate, and a commentator for CBS and Voice of America. He is the author of the new book, Blacklisted by History, The Untold Story of Senator Joe McCarthy and His Fight Against America's Enemies. And he joins us by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
No, I'm from Appleton, Wisconsin, so I know of Joe McCarthy. Why did you decide to take on Joe McCarthy as your subject for this book?
Well, first of all, Joy, please call me Stan through the interview.
Okay.
Just a further note in my vita, I also was a commentator for NPR for several years.
Okay.
So I'm sort of NPR alum here. To answer your question, I'm of an age, I'm in my early 70s, to remember all this stuff. This was all happening when I was senior in high school and then in college. So Joe McCarthy was a huge, huge issue of my youth, formative years. And, of course, McCarthy was simply a story within a story, the big story of really my journalistic lifetime, and now over 50 years, was the Cold War and the battle between the United States and the Western world and the Soviet world. And McCarthy was a player in that drama. And so these were issues that have been imprinted in my thinking for a long time. And what finally brought me back around to doing this book was that in the early 90s and since then, materials have become available that were not available back in 1953, FBI files in particular, which I've worked on a lot, but also from the Soviet archives, the so-called Venona papers, which are messages back and forth between the Soviet intelligence bosses in Moscow and their agents over here. And so there's quite a bit of stuff now that you can look at, and if you have the McCarthy case names, you can go through this material and look for them, and that's what I did, and that's how this book evolved.
Yeah, well, and you say, though, that a lot of the stuff you were looking for, you couldn't find.
That is true. A lot of stuff, you obviously, you read the book.
Well, as much as I could, yeah.
unlike some other people that have interviewed me, and I appreciate that. A lot of stuff turned up missing, and one has to wonder why. On the other hand, I did find a lot of stuff. If you keep after, you can find stuff. One of the great things about America, and there are many great things about it, is it's a very decentralized country. So things, copies of documents that are not found in one place may show up in another place, and that's kind of what happened in my research.
Yeah, but there were, lists of communists that were infamous, but you never were able to find that list.
Well, I did. If you look at one of the things that disappeared was the McCarthy's list of cases.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, that's kind of the Rosetta Stone of the whole deal. If you don't have that, you really don't, what are you looking for? And so I, by sheer happenstance, and this is part of it, I guess, just being lucky, got those names. And if you look at the book, I don't know if you have it there. Do you have it there?
Yes. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Okay, if you look at the back in the appendix, page 633, I think, you'll see there they are.
Yeah. Well, talk about some. You do think that there had been some covering up, though.
Oh, absolutely. And if I can just recap the larger story briefly for your listeners. What happened was that during World War II in particular, although it started in the Depression, there was indeed a very extensive penetration of the federal government by communists, Soviet agents, fellow travelers, and so on. And this was thing that was particularly of interest to anybody back then, because the Soviet Union was our ally, and nobody was really kind of paying attention to whether their communists were getting in the government or not. But after the war, everything changed, and starting in 1945, the Soviets started cracking down, like in Poland and so on, and the Cold War started, and so a totally different atmosphere developed, and penetration by communists that was looking pretty innocent in 1943 or 4 looked kind of different in 1946. And so people who had let this happen were not real anxious to have this spread out before the nation, and in essence covered it up. And that's a complicated story in itself, but Joe McCarthy came down the road in 1950 and found some of these dossiers and blew the lid off, and that's where all the controversy came from.
Yeah. Well, you know what? Let's start a little bit. Let's start at the beginning and talk about Joe McCarthy's upbringing. He was born in Grand Chute and raised in the Appleton area.
Yeah. Well, I'm no expert on all that. You probably know more about that than I do. I've been out there and been up to the McCarthy Farm, McCarthy Road, and all of that, and to the gravesite by the Fox River and all of that. But I really, this book is not really a biography of Joe McCarthy.
I know it's not, but I thought you did write about it, and sort of it tells you where his
roots, mm-hmm. right? Well, as you know from the book, and you would know anyway, he was the son of a second-generation Irish Catholic couple that had settled up there outside Appleton, Timothy and Bridget McCarthy, and the family were devout Catholics, part of the so-called Irish settlement up there. And they were frugal and hard-working people. They weren't destitute, but there was never a lot of money to go around. And Joe McCarthy, from a very early age, had to work to help keep the family going, and because of that, did not attend high school. And he realized at the age of 19, and then really just about the time he was turning 20, that if he wanted to be anything, he had to get an education. And he attended high school, and in for 9 months, did 4 years' work, and graduated with honors from his high school. Went to Marquette, where he started off in pre-engineering, switched to pre-law, got his law degree there in 35, and hung his shingle out in Waupaca in 35, and became a lawyer up there. And in 39, if I'm remembering correctly, ran for circuit judge, became the youngest circuit judge in Wisconsin. In 42, of course, the war broke out, went into the Marines, served in the South Pacific, came back in 1946, ran against Senator La Follette Jr. in the Republican primary, won that primary in a stunning upset, and then cruised home to a victory in the fall, and became the youngest U.S. Senator in the country. And so that was his vita very briefly.
Well, yeah, it wasn't. And it,
a man destroyed.
I didn't know all of those details about his upbringing.
Okay,
I mean, he got the. I mean, he gave up that judgeship to join
to
the.
To go to the war.
To go to the war, yeah.
Yeah. And he didn't have to. He was exempt from the draft.
And he got the tail gunner Joe.
Well, that became a huge controversy as to whether, how many missions he flew and so forth. And all of that's in all the standard bios of McCarthy. I didn't do any particularly original research. The probably the best treatment of all of that is Professor Thomas Reeves' book, The Life and Times of Joe McCarthy. He's a critic of McCarthy, but he knows a lot about McCarthy.
Yeah, did you? Did you sense that that Joe McCarthy was some sort of, I don't know, power grabbing, power hungry, wild eyed, ambitious politician here?
No, ma'am, I didn't. And of course, I'm to just emphasize what I was trying to do. I went down sort of the other trail, which was. I wasn't really doing a personality assessment of Joe McCarthy, although that's inevitable. Looking at all this stuff, you have to come up with some judgment about him as a person. Mm-hmm. But I was looking at the cases, and the question was really the truth or falsehood of the assertions that he made about the level of communist penetration of the government, about what was going on in the State Department at that period, about whether or not the thing had been covered up. And so most of my book is about those matters as opposed to Joe McCarthy as a personality.
Yeah. We're talking with Stan Evans, who is the author of the book Blacklisted by History, The Untold Story of Senator Joe McCarthy and His Fight Against America's Enemies. We will welcome your thoughts and questions for our guest at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Our guest says that while people still call Joe McCarthy a demagogue, a bully, a liar, probably everything you know about Joe McCarthy is wrong. And he says, essentially, Joe McCarthy was right. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Happy to have you along. Hope you stay tuned. Coming up this afternoon, it's Talk of the Nation after 1. Sexual abuse by teachers might be more common than you think. More about that coming up after 1 o'clock on Talk of the Nation. We're talking about Senator Joe McCarthy with the author of the book Blacklisted by History, The Untold Story of Senator Joe McCarthy and His Fight Against America's Enemies. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890, or talk at WPR.org. Stan Evans, talk some about, you say that almost everything we've heard about Joe McCarthy is wrong. Why? Why was everyone telling lies about Joe McCarthy?
Well, I think, again, to circle back to something I said earlier, McCarthy was really a player in a much larger drama, and it was really the larger drama that dictated some of the things that happened concerning him. The issue was not some person named McCarthy. The issue was the question of whether or not the American government had in fact been infiltrated by communists and Soviet agents and spies and so forth and so on. And McCarthy was saying, yeah, it was, and here are some examples of it, and it's been covered up and so on. The people on the other side, and there were numerous, had a vested interest in not hearing this and in denying it, and did deny it, and in fact covered it up. And he was a threat to that that process. And so that's what made him so intensely controversial. But it was really the underlying issue at stake here that needed to be resolved, not things McCarthy said or things McCarthy did, but the issue he was addressing.
Yeah. You also, though, mentioned that the East Coasters or the editorial cartoonists thought that he was some disheveled, caveman.
Yeah, well, they certainly conveyed that image of McCarthy, and there were attributes of McCarthy that lent themselves to that. He had a kind of heavy, stubbly beard, so that... Mm-hmm. The 5 o'clock shadow, so that was lent itself to caricature. And he wasn't a smoothie by any means. He was a kind of rough and tumble guy that had made his way up from humble beginnings, and he was up against a bunch of Ivy League sophisticates that looked down their noses at him. And so there were elements there that lent themselves to that kind of treatment. To some degree, he was kind of like the character in that he was not a smooth sophisticate. But the issue was always not him, but the underlying question, and that's what was really being covered up, as opposed to just attacking him.
Yeah. And what has come to light that you say it vindicates Joe McCarthy?
If you've got the book there...
For our listeners who don't have the book there.
Sure, yeah, I'm going to describe it to them and to you, but you can take a look at while I'm doing it. If you look on page 146 of my book, what you will see there is a chart which was drawn up by the FBI, which I found in the confidential files of J. Edgar Hoover, and which Hoover had issued reports to higher-ups in the United States government beginning in the early 40s, but intensively after 1945, up through the middle of 1948 when this chart was drawn up. And if you look at that, have you got it there, Joy?
Yes.
Okay, you can see it looks like a spider web because there's so many lines in this chart. The bottom of the chart are the names of 27 principal suspects, one of them being Alger Hiss, another one being Harry Dexter White, mm-hmm. and so on, Solomon Adler, and so forth. And these were officials in the government who had been subjects of investigative interest to the FBI because of the testimony of Elizabeth Bentley and their own surveillance. And at the top line, these are the offices of the federal government to whom reports were sent concerning all these people. So you can see it's a mass of lines going all over the place, mostly to the White House, the Attorney General, State Department, and so on, in which the FBI had reported all this stuff to higher-ups in the government, and little or nothing had been done about any of this. It was just all under the rug. And that was what was there. That's what the records show was going on. And this, I got this file, this chart, one of many such charts, from the FBI a couple of years ago. It's indicative of the massive reporting that was being done by Hoover and the Bureau. And the number of reports, there's 370 by my account reflects in this chart, was received by higher-ups, and virtually nothing was done about the problem. And that's what's now available to us that wasn't available then, that kind of thing.
Yeah. But you also say that McCarthy wasn't right about everything he said.
No, he wasn't. I guess probably his biggest gaffe was the speech about George Marshall. And oddly enough, I'm sitting here about 10 miles from George Marshall's home in Leesburg, Virginia. He had the right crime, but the wrong culprit. He said there was an immense conspiracy afoot, and there was, but he wrongly thought Marshall was the guy running it, and he wasn't, in my view. And the conspiracy included such things, going back to World War II, as plans to assassinate, I stress, our ally Chiang Kai-shek, our anti-communist ally Chiang Kai-shek, in 1944, and later, in 1950, to foment a coup d'etat against Chiang Kai-shek when he was on Formosa. This all done by high-up elements in our government. This was indeed an immense conspiracy, but George Marshall was pretty much being manipulated and not in charge of it.
We have a number of callers who have questions. Let me go to Dick in Shorewood. Hi, Dick. You're on the air.
Okay. I'd like to get your guest's assessment of the journalist Edwin Bailey's book. I can't remember the name of it, but it came out a few years ago, and it focused mainly on McCarthy's political life and his political downfall. You know, because it struck me as when I read it, it seemed, I think Bailey was a fairly good journalist, and it seemed fairly objective to me.
Well, I've read it. I think it's called Joe McCarthy in the Press, I have read that book. It has some useful information in it, but I guess my caveat about that book and any book, and I would have to go back and look at it more particularly to answer your question better, is that be very careful about the generalizations about the cases. What Bailey was mostly looking at was the press coverage of McCarthy, and there's a lot of useful information about that. But there are dicta in his book and all these other books about certain things, like what McCarthy said at Wheeling, West Virginia, about the 205 and the 57, and that's another thing we could talk about, that he's simply taking from other people's research. And in case after case after case, those dicta are not correct.
Let me also get your reaction to a review of your book by Kirkus Reviews, and it's very complimentary in one sense and not in another, but it says, the book is exhaustively researched and impeccably sourced as it traces the rise of the Communist Party from the 1930s upward or onward and identifies the lives and careers of fellow travelers as they work their way through the State Department. Though overlong, it's well-written and accessible. But it's highly unlikely that Evans will win any converts. McCarthy wasn't a victim, but a craven brute who played fast and loose with the facts, someone perfectly willing to destroy lives and reputations for political gain. A clear-eyed account of the Communist Party in mid-century would be most welcome, but it would need to include an honest appraisal of the man properly regarded as its chief villain, rather than the commie under your bed conspiracy that Evans lays out here.
Well, that's a pretty good recap of the conventional view of McCarthy. It's not, however, doesn't give you much to grab hold of, since there are no facts in that. It's just a bunch of generalizations. And my contention is that it's in the facts that you find the answers to those generalizations, just like this chart that you and I were discussing a moment ago. And I don't think I've seen that Kirkus review, but that's fairly typical of what's out there in some circles. And I don't expect to make any converts among people that have that kind of reflexive action, reaction. I do expect to make some converts among people who are open-minded.
Yeah. McCarthy wasn't a craven brute who played fast and loose with the facts?
No.
Yeah.
That's what my entire book is about, saying no to that question.
Yeah. And what about, I mean, that's the thing that, you know, that we all hear about, is that that McCarthy did destroy lives and reputations for political gain.
Okay.
And why isn't that true?
Well, I would say to that, name one. Who are we talking about? Who did he destroy, and what are the specifics? And because I've studied it and a lot of people haven't, it's a hard question for anybody to answer, so I'll give an answer myself. The main answer that is given to that is a woman named Annie Lee Moss, who, did you see the George Clooney movie a couple of years ago?
Mm-hmm.
Good Night and Good Luck.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay, you may remember that this case is featured in that movie. It was featured by Edward R. Murrow back in 1954, and then Clooney replayed some of the same clips, the whole burden of which was this woman was an innocent victim of McCarthy, and brought before him and smeared, and it was a case of mistaken identity and so forth. All of that is totally bogus, and I have an entire chapter devoted to that case and to the Clooney movie, to the FBI files about the person in question. And you look at all that information, it's very clear that what McCarthy was saying was correct, what Clooney is implying is wrong, what Murrow is implying was wrong. And that's just one example among many, but it's probably the most famous example.
Yeah. Karen in Platteville is with us. Hi, Karen. You're on the air.
Hi. My cousin was General Secretary of the American Association of University Professors during 1955 to 1957. And he said just because a person called themselves a communist wasn't grounds for doing away with their freedom of speech or association. Can your guest tell us how McCarthy interacted with academics?
He had very little to do with academics. McCarthy's focus was not on, a lot of people think, for example, that McCarthy had something to do with the Hollywood investigation. It had nothing to do with that. He did not investigate college professors per se. He did look at certain people in the academy who had connection to defense research. That was one of his main issues. And everything that he was involved with revolved around the question of whether there was somebody was in the U.S. government, in the policymaking realm, who was susceptible to foreign influence or was an agent of the Soviet Union, something of that nature. All his cases were about people in the government, not private individuals. And certainly the generalization that the lady just made, quoting her, relation, is true that under our law, then and now, and I certainly don't disagree with this, that someone has every right in the world to believe in communism or Marxism or be a member of the Communist Party, but that's different from being holding a position in the government, and the law is very much very clear on that there was no such right.
Yeah. Thank you, Karen. Larry in Whitehall. Hi, Larry. You're on the air.
Hi. 10 or 15 years ago, I read that the Venona papers were made available from Moscow during Perestroika Glasnost period. I thought that news would blow the lid off, that it would be front page stuff, and I never heard about it again until this morning. Would you talk a little bit about what those Venona papers said?
Yes, sir. Just to explain for the listeners, Joy, that's just a made-up name. It was a code name that the Army's security agency invented for a project that dated way back to World War II, in which cryptologists working for the Army were intercepting cables from Moscow to their agents here in the United States, giving them directions as to what to do and discussing problems, discussing projects they had. And these were all in code, and the Soviets were so confident that their code was unbreakable that they didn't really, try to conceal these cables. They just sent them. And so we got them, our people got them, and they did succeed in cracking the codes in which they were embedded. And from those cables came up with a lot of information about what the Soviets were doing back in the 1940s and shared this information with the FBI beginning in 1948. And that helped to crack a lot of the Soviet networks because a lot of agents were named in these cables. For example, one of them was a guy named Lachlan Curry, who was a high official in the White House. Another one was Harry Dexter White, and who was high in the Treasury and so on. So these people were named by the Soviets themselves and by their agents over here as people complicit in this penetration. Those cables were kept secret for 50 years and were finally released for public consumption in 1995, primarily through the influence of Senator Pat Moynihan of New York, who took a great interest in this and got them finally published. And that's the background on the Venona papers.
We're talking with Stan Evans, about his book, Blacklisted by History, The Untold Story of Senator Joe McCarthy and His Fight Against America's Enemies. 1-800-642-1234. If you have a question or maybe a challenge for him, 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine, hoping you'll stay tuned. Coming up, Kathleen Dunn is with you between 9 and 11. She'll host her November open line after 9 and talk with a guest about the history of children at play after 10. We're talking about history, in a sense, the history of Senator Joe McCarthy. Our guest says that Joe McCarthy was unfairly blacklisted by history. He's written a book, The Untold Story of Senator Joe McCarthy and His Fight Against America's Enemies, saying that Joe McCarthy was right about communist infiltration of the U.S. government, and that probably everything that we have heard about Joe McCarthy is wrong. Our next caller is Dan in White Lake. Hi, Dan. You're on the air.
Good morning. My thought is that the reason behind the antipathy toward communists and government is because of the godlessness of communism and the extreme antipathy of Americans toward atheists. So we say communists had infiltrated the government, but currently we have a number of neocons in and around the government. Norman Podhoretz, Paul Wolfowitz, Dick Cheney, so on and so forth, who are principally responsible for us being in Iraq and who would love to get us into a war with Iran and will if they can.
What do you think about Joe McCarthy, though?
But it's the godlessness that he picked up on, and that's what played with the American public, whereas smart people know God is a creature of man, not vice versa. And I'll listen to your comments.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm not going to, going to go down the road into Iraq and Iran. Joy, I told somebody, asked me about that. If it happened after 1954, I don't know anything about it. So I'm not going to get involved in that. But to go back to the fundamental points the gentleman is making, I'm sure that the antagonism to communism generally was indeed fueled by what he said. An atheist movement, and America is by and large a very religious country, certainly was then, and I think still is to some degree. However, that wasn't really the issue that Joe McCarthy was isolating, although he did talk about that. It was the fact that a member of the Communist Party, or sympathizer with communism, was by implication, and sometimes very explicitly, the agent of a hostile foreign power, namely the Soviet Union. So this is what all the laws and regulations were based on back then. The fact that the concern was that somebody like an Alger Hiss or Harry Dexter White or Solomon Adler, who was agent in the Treasury Department, were using their positions in the American government to serve the interests of the Soviet Union and the communist movement generally. That was the problem, not their atheism.
Thank you, Dan, for the call. Dee in Sheboygan is with us now. Hi, Dee, you're on the air.
I'm wondering how you can dare to rehabilitate this man, this scoundrel. When he was active in the Senate, we organized a recall petition for him, and we had a lot of support here in Sheboygan.
Yeah, why did you organize a recall, Dee?
Pardon?
Why did you organize the recall?
Because he was such a scoundrel.
What did he do that made him a scoundrel?
Well, he came to the Senate floor with a long list of people, over 100 people, who he claimed were communists. And every day he would come with another list. And he just wasn't fit to be a senator.
Hmm. Well, may I respond to that?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
What Dee is saying is certainly the convention. I think that was the Joe Must Go campaign of Leroy Gore, if I remember correctly or read about it correctly. And that certainly was the premise of everything was done against McCarthy was that he was lying about these cases. And what the lady just said was he came to the floor with some list of names, blah, blah, blah. Well, that's what everybody was assuming then or saying then. Well, now we have the names, and I referred to them a moment ago. They're in the appendix to my book, and if you have those names, you can then go through the records of the FBI, and I did that, and there you will find these people. These were not things that Joe McCarthy made up. This was information that came to him probably through the State Department Security Office, but maybe through other routes as well, but ultimately the source of it was the FBI.
Is that what you're trying to do, rehabilitate Joe McCarthy, Stan Evans?
I'm trying to get the history straight. As a matter of, I'm a journalist, as you are, Joy, and as you know, the holy grail of our business is to get the facts right. That's what everything is supposed to be about, and on this issue, the facts aren't right. They're wrong, and so that's what I'm trying to do is to do what we're supposed to do and get them straight.
Yeah, so all the senators, Joe McCarthy's colleagues who censured him, they didn't have their facts straight.
Well, that's certainly true. But the facts had almost nothing to do with the censure. I have a chapter devoted to the censure.
Right. Now, talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, well, the censure, as long as McCarthy was going up against Harry Truman, and this is all ancient history, and for some of your listeners, it's like talking about the Civil War or something. It's so long ago. But as long as he was going up against Truman, he could count on the backing of his colleagues in the Senate. And I have chapters devoted to those fights in which Truman and Senator Tidings, who was the Democratic senator that first condemned McCarthy, were battling with the Republicans in the Senate. And the Republicans in the Senate, including moderates like Henry Cabot Lodge and Irving Ives of New York and Alexander Smith of New Jersey, these are all Eastern moderate-type Republicans, were all on McCarthy's side in those battles. But once a Republican president came in, Eisenhower, and then I go into why this happened, Eisenhower had a strong antagonism toward McCarthy because of the George Marshall speech and some other things. And there were people around Ike who prompted him to do battle with McCarthy, and I write about several of those episodes. Once that happened, and once it became to open warfare with a Republican White House as opposed to a Democratic White House, and there were lots of Republicans, about half of them, who went with the White House instead of with McCarthy. And that's what happened. The censure vote was all the Democrats and half the Republicans, which made like two-thirds of the Congress, of the Senate. So that's how he got censured.
Yeah. And then he died just a couple years after that.
Joe McCarthy died May 2nd, 1957, so he died 50 years ago this year.
That's right. And he was only 48 years old.
48 years
that's
old.
A very young man. And it was attributed to maybe boozing
drinking.
It too much after that? Yeah.
Yeah, that's the general story. I talked to, there's a person still with us, hard to believe, but fortunate for me, true, who knew McCarthy very well, right up to the end. His name is Jim Juliana. He was a staffer for McCarthy. He's a man now in his 80s, but still, you know, very vigorous and sharp. And I talked to him a lot, and he had a lot of files from that era. But I specifically asked him about this drunk charge, and he denied it. But there are other people that knew him well who said it was true. So I'm sort of an agnostic on it. I would say that I said to somebody who interviewed me, I think if everything had happened to McCarthy, it happened to me, I would have taken a few belts myself.
Yeah.
Because he went through a lot in a very short time.
Greg in Milwaukee is with us. Hi, Greg.
Yes, my understanding is that the FBI had known about communists in the U.S. government since the 30s, but
yeah.
A Supreme Court decision from that time prevented the use of wiretaps, and that most of the information the FBI had was through wiretaps, but that that information couldn't be used in court to convict anybody for espionage. And so the U.S. government was really kind of on top of this, but wanted to follow the communications lines. And doesn't that mean that McCarthy was basically blowing the cover on this?
Well, first of all, your description of what was going on is pretty accurate. Yeah, they were all over it, particularly beginning in the early 40s, and there was a lot of wiretapping, which went on for a long time. I have a lot of wiretap records in my possession, and I refer to a lot of them in my book. But what McCarthy was doing, he did not blow the lid off something that was a current case. These were pretty much cold case situations by the time he came along. The FBI had been delving into the issue of communist penetration of the government, at least since 42, intensively since 45. All of this was pretty much shoved under the rug. Some of it at least, came trickling out in the late 40s, like the Hiss-Chambers case. But it was all then covered up by a secrecy order by President Truman in March of 48, and that kind of put the lid on the kettle. McCarthy came along and blew that lid off. I don't think the FBI objected for 1 minute to what McCarthy was doing. I don't see that in the files. I think that probably, in fact, he was getting some of his information from the FBI.
Thank you, Greg. Larry in Madison is with us now. Hi, Larry.
Hi. I wanted to quote shortly from a book called In Denial, which was written by Haynes and Clare, who are co-authors of a book about the Venona Papers.
Right.
On 2 points. First, about communists in the United States. most Americans who spied for the Soviet Union were members of the Communist Party of the USA. That organization had an underground apparatus that cooperated with both the KGB and the GRU, checking out prospective spies, providing safe houses, recruiting couriers, and supplying false passports. The Communist Party of the USA was not just another American political party operating according to the legal rules or the established practices of ordinary political organizations, and they were not a body of independent-minded heretics, even though not everyone who was a communist was linked to Soviet espionage. However, at the same time, Claire says, but I can't see any data, they said that the Venona papers, while documenting the Communist Party USA's integral role in the Soviet Union's massive espionage against the United States, offer no support for McCarthy's wild and irresponsible charges against the Truman and Roosevelt administration. So I'd like your comments on that.
Okay, well, first of all, I'm glad you read that. I know both John Haynes and Harvey Clare, and I have the highest respect for both of them. And that's a good book, and their other books are good books. They're very, very good on the question of communist infiltration. They've really done a lot of work on Venona, done a lot of work on the Soviet archives and so forth, and I respect their work highly. On the question of McCarthy, we differ, although I think maybe the differences are narrowing as more research is done all over the place by many people. But they have not, and I think they would admit this, really done much research on McCarthy's cases. I've shared some information with them, and they've shared some with me. But they really, the dicta they offer about McCarthy and others do, that people also that I respect, really are just based on taking the conventional view of McCarthy and repeating it. And what has been needed all along is to look at the McCarthy cases themselves, and that's what I've been trying to do.
All right, thank you very much, Larry. Tom in Menominee. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello, I just had a comment. My parents, I was old enough to remember some of the tales of McCarthy era, but my parents were friends with a number of people later in public life who knew Joe McCarthy in law school at the University of Wisconsin. Gaylord Nelson, Robert Lewis, later in the USDA, a number of people. And they knew him as somebody who was manipulative, inclined to twist the truth, and inclined to unnecessarily damage people's reputations and try to isolate them. And what I want to point out here is a character of him, and I want to say just a little bit more about that, that it was not just that he pointed out facts and that some facts that were maybe not accessible to everyone, but the way he turned that to red baiting and fear mongering and that kind of thing. One case in point was, and you mentioned academics not having had a lot of contact with that issue, but at one point he attacked the University of Wisconsin library through the library system, saying that there were communist books and books by communists there, and the Board of Regents had anticipated this and seen it coming and had been prepared for it. And the statement, I believe it was E.B. Fred, but president of the university at the time, said, "The University of Wisconsin libraries are open to all citizens of Wisconsin. You're a citizen of Wisconsin. You can go in and read them at any time." And that was the end of it. All he had wanted to do was stir up a red baiting kind of thing, and he was deflated by that. So I'm interested in your comments on those things.
Okay, well, I've covered a lot of territory there. Just go back to the gentleman's reference to his family, and mentioned Gaylord Nelson. With all due respect to Gaylord Nelson, he was hardly an objective observer. He was this huge political enemy of Joe McCarthy, former Democratic senator from Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. So not exactly the most impartial source you might cite. In terms of the library thing, the main library issue that McCarthy brought up, and the Wisconsin Library might have gotten involved in this somehow, but mostly it was the USIA libraries over in Europe And that became a huge issue. That was the Cohn Shine trip to Europe and all of that. And McCarthy was basically right about that. There were communist books in those libraries. And even James Conant, who was the head of the High Commissioner's Office in Germany, and President Eisenhower and other people, when forced to confront this, said, well, basically that's right. We should not have communist books in official U.S. libraries overseas, which was the only point McCarthy was making. So that was really the big library issue that he addressed, and it was always a question of, again, what was an official act as opposed to a private act, and whether official acts should be supporting the communist point of view, in this case, the USIA libraries, and he said they shouldn't.
Yeah. Thank you, Tom. Ronald in Milwaukee. Hi, you're on the air.
Good morning. I have two questions to ask your guest. One is, did Senator McCarthy, was he an alcoholic? And the other question is, I believe he was supposed to produce the list of communist sympathizers, and Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz were on those lists. I'd like to know if that was true or false.
Yep. Okay, well, let me begin with the last part. Joe McCarthy, Lucille Ball, and Desi Arnaz were, of course, Hollywood people. McCarthy conducted no investigation of Hollywood. That was the House Committee on Un-American Activities. I've seen no lists of McCarthy cases, and I've looked at quite a few McCarthy cases that included Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz. Maybe some such list existed somewhere, but if so, I don't know where it is, and it probably doesn't exist.
Yeah.
Probably is no such list. But McCarthy did have lists of cases that were people in the government, in the State Department in particular, but elsewhere in the government, and those are the lists that I reproduce in my book.
Yeah, and we've already addressed the drinking issue.
You do
mention that McCarthy is often called the chairman of this House Committee on American Activities when he was a senator, and he had nothing to do with that committee.
That's correct. Yeah, and if I've done nothing else in this bunch of interviews I've done on this, I've spread the word that we have a bicameral legislative system,
mm-hmm.
House and Senate, and they're different, and a senator wasn't head of House Committee.
Yeah, we have less than a minute left, but I wanted to talk to you about how McCarthy's name has become synonymous with fear-mongering, and it's actually become a word in itself, McCarthyism.
It's in the dictionary. You're right, and which is testimony to something. I'm not sure what it is. I can't explain it in the short time we have, but it's wrong, and that's the point of my book.
Yeah. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Joy.
Yeah. M. Staton Evans, he is the author of Blacklisted by History, The Untold Story of Senator Joe McCarthy and His Fight Against America's Enemies. Thanks to Carmen Jackson for producing this program. Thanks to Leo Duran for on-air production. Thank you for listening. And for calling in. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.